Well, there's nothing like a bit of Franco-British brinkmanship to sell tabloids and provide convenient foils for under-pressure politicians. Livelihoods are very much at stake in the very Franco-British row unfolding, and it's not taking the bait to worry over suspended fishing licenses and the sequester of a trawler. We'll gauge the mood after the visit to Paris of Boris Johnson's Brexit minister, David Frost. His next stop is Brussels. Can a solution be found on fishing and broader trade issues? Or to be blunt, do the two sides actually want to compromise? Does a bit of cross-channel flag-waving suit both leaders, a Boris Johnson who faces the double whammy of surging energy prices and post-Brexit uncertainty, and an Emmanuel Macron who's up for re-election in 6 months and has his own worries over fuel prices and migrants putting a strain on coastal communities? The pair have more in common than just speaking each other's language. They share a penchant for strong leadership and paint themselves as disruptors. But what are the unintended consequences of a pinch of populism? Not for the leaders, but for the nations that they govern, and dare we say, for all of Europe. Today in the France 24 debate, are we rising to the bait with this fishing row? And joining us, Pierre-Jérôme Ménin, founder of public relations consultants, The Progressive Company. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
From London, Catherine Barnard, the deputy director of the think tank UK in a Changing Europe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much indeed.
We'll be joined shortly by Matt Kilcoyne, director of the Initiative for Free Trade, the France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. Yeah, put aside the quips about the Battle of Trafalgar, the pain and the anguish is real for fishermen on both sides of the channel, like in the Normandy fishing town of Le Tréport. Fishing rights definitely on the agenda in Paris when David Frost came to town. Emerald Maxwell has more.
It was the first effort to relaunch dialogue after weeks of rising tension. The French European Affairs Minister and the British Brexit Minister say they've laid out their concerns in the fishing rights row. Admitting there are still many difficulties to overcome, they will resume talks early next week. That can't come soon enough for this fisherman in Le Tréport. His boat has been moored for months.
We changed boats in 2018 and we did work on it without increasing our fishing capacity. And now they don't want to give us a license. I've been fishing along the English coast for 30 years. We've been there for ages, but they still said no.
Four vessels like his from this port in Normandy have been refused a license by London and have had to fall back on coastal French waters. This raises the risk of overexploiting local fish stocks, says this union representative.
All these vessels will be forced to fish in the same waters, and as they will all go for the same type of fish, it will create an imbalance in the market.
This local fishmonger is also bearing the brunt of the diplomatic arm wrestle. He's been able to get hold of half the types of fish he usually sells.
I hope it gets better in time for Christmas. This is a loss of income for everyone. It's hard to know what to do.
The local maritime economy remains suspended. It's a drop in the ocean in terms of overall France-UK trade, but neither the French nor British leader wants to blink first. One in the wake of Brexit, and the other as he eyes re-election in the spring.
Pierre-Jérôme Ménin, it's Thursday and things are cooling off a little bit. The two sides talking, the Brexit minister in town. At the start of the week, it looked tense. What with there was that British trawler that was sequestered by the French. For you, what is this all about?
Well, it's a way of expressing the fact that the Brexit was really a lose-lose game for everyone. It's sort of a little war between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron. Boris Johnson has a lot to gain in this. You know, it's the usual rhetoric of the common enemy, and France is the best one. The frogs are the best one to be our enemies. And he has a lot to gain, and he has, you know, polls to... he has to be better in the polls. He has lost a lot of his positive side in the polls due to the way he handled the COVID crisis. Due to the fact that there are shortages.
But let's talk for a second about fishing itself.
Yeah.
For years, British fishermen complained that there was overfishing by other European states in their waters.
Well, Up until the Brexit, the fishing policy in the European Union was regulated by the fishing common policy. So it meant that all countries could go in other EU countries to fish. So it was a EU policy. It still is at the EU level, as not only French fishermen are concerned, but other Spanish, Danish, Dutch, Belgium are also concerned. So it's always been regulated, and the UK was part of this regulation. So they can complain, but still it was an EU regulation, and their minister, the British minister, was at the table when things were agreed for that common fish policy, fishery policy.
Yeah, Catherine Barnard, there's a bit of a numbers game going on here. I noticed that the Brexit secretary is saying 96% of the licenses have been granted, but of course he left out the licenses granted by Jersey and Guernsey.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion about numbers. And indeed, Lord Frost said 98% of licences had been granted. Where there's deep confusion is how many licences have been granted around the waters in Jersey and Guernsey. And specifically, the point that came up on your film, which is what about those people, those fishermen who've been fishing for a long time, but they've got new boats which had not been used for a long period of time prior to 2016. And so there is a real confusion about numbers. Lord Frost published a paper yesterday to try and clarify, but as one commentator said, the clarifications were about as clear as the mud at the bottom of the channel. So there is uncertainty, but we're probably talking about 50 or 60 licenses which are being disputed.
Are we paying too much attention to this?
Yes and no. I mean, in economic terms, fisheries is just tiny. I mean, for the UK, it's less than 0.1% of the economy. For France, it's much smaller. But fisheries have always been symbolic and disproportionately symbolic. And for the British, it's worth bearing in mind that British fishermen and women voted to a man and woman to leave the EU because they'd been promised that they would get a really good deal. In reality, they didn't get a good deal. And indeed, anyone who exports to the continent is now faced with a barrage of paperwork. And so they feel deeply let down by Boris Johnson's deal. And so it's very important for him to be showing to the fishermen and women that this is that he's willing to fight their corner. And of course, on the French side, Emmanuel Macron wants to make the point that leaving the EU comes with significant pain attached in order to speak to those in his own country who attempted to do a Frexit. And of course, he's got elections coming up, so he wants to be seen to be a strong man.
Wants to be seen to be a strong man. And we did see tempers flare last week when Politico first reported on a letter sent by the French Prime Minister to the President of the European Commission, Jean Castex, arguing it was vital to clearly show, quote, European public opinion that respect of signed agreements is non-negotiable and that there's more disadvantage in leaving the European Union than in remaining. Of course, the word in French was dommage, and that invited a linguistic row over how to best translate in this context. But even if you give Castex the benefit of the doubt, he's still asking the EU to play hardball with Britain. Is it the wrong rhetoric to be employing?
I don't think he's asking the EU to play hardball with Britain. He's just asking the EU to make sure that the treaties are respected. That's all. I mean, we're not going beyond that. There was a treaty that needed to be respected regarding the fishermen and the fishery policies. There's also a treaty to be respected regarding the commercial relationships between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So they put everything upside down across the channel, and the Prime Minister is just asking the treaty to be respected. It doesn't go beyond that.
Okay, I think I hear the voice of Matt Kilcoyne. Not yet. Okay, well, we're going to cross over to him in a short moment. Catherine Barnard, Is this going to run and run and run even after the French elections?
Oh, absolutely, because Boris Johnson has had polling which shows that the one thing that unites the very disparate groups of people who voted to leave the European Union is constant attacks on the European Union. Because if you think about it, the people who voted to leave, on the one hand, you've got those who are mercantilist free traders who are desperate to do trade deals across the globe. And on the other hand, you've got those who want a big state, who want to be looked after by the state and want to have a high tax, not on them, high spend economy. And of course, the two groups have got very little in common, apart from the fact that they don't like the EU and they wanted Brexit. And so it's actually in Boris Johnson's political interest to try and keep those different factions on board to keep provoking the EU.
Let's now cross to Matt Kilcoyne, Director of the Initiative for Free Trade. Thank you for joining us from London here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you agree that for Boris Johnson, there's no mileage in reaching a deal anytime soon?
No, Boris wants a deal. Lord Frost wants a deal. They've made that very clear. They've given out their terms. They've set them out. They've actually said what their challenge and aspiration that they want the EU to rise to is. Now, there is an element to which Boris is not necessarily delivering the best on his public policy at home, in the same way that Macron's reforms haven't necessarily been performing very well in France ahead of an election next year. And to be seen that Britain is at loggerheads with France goes down very well with the public, in the same way that being seen that France is standing up to Britain does very well with the French public. So there's a little bit of distraction on that. I would say that very little was achieved. Very little wasn't achieved this week. I think next week, Britain's going to carry on being ambitious with its proposals because they do want a deal. It's just right now, nobody in Europe seems to want the deal that's actually achievable.
What do you mean by ambitious?
Well, they're saying that a lot of the stuff on quotas is really very small fry, quite literally, a spat over sprats. But things around the Northern Irish question about whether the ECJ should have a role in Northern Ireland going forward, despite the fact that the whole of the United Kingdom as a whole across Brexit voted to leave the European Union, and therefore the trappings and jurisdiction of the ECJ with it. I think they are looking at things like mutual recognition. They're looking at way in which goods could be seen to be recorded by companies, but not necessarily regarded by the governments, and therefore allowing some transactions that happen across border that right now are being hindered. They're looking at ways in which goods can be, that consumers are put first, not corporations and not governments. So that anybody who is able to buy something from Amazon in the whole of, in one part of the United Kingdom, is able to buy it in any part of the United Kingdom. And actually, when they're saying this, the internal market of the United Kingdom is much more ambitious than the single market of the European Union, which harmonizes goods and different responsibilities. Actually, the internal market of the United Kingdom respects devolution and allows different legislations. It just makes the consumer the king of whether that legislation is actually seen as useful.
So are you suggesting that the Europe and France are trying to punish Britain?
No, I'm saying that Europe and France is not being ambitious in its outlook enough. It's not seeing Britain as a trusting partner, and it's seeing it as a wrecking mechanism for the rest of Europe. Britain's moved on. Britain not thinking about Europe anymore. I know it's hard to take it, but it's just not thinking about you. It's not in love with the EU. It's looking about its trade deals with the rest of the world, how it can work to ensure that actually it treats them as equal partners, whether it's Australia or New Zealand or Canada or the United States. The trade deals that the UK is looking at makes it clear that they want to do mutual recognition, trusted partners on the world stage that want to see the same outcome, those health and safety standards, those environmental standards, to be equivalent. Because we trust our legislatures in each other's democracies. The European model is one that was built to harmonize various countries, whether they were ex-fascist countries, ex-communist countries, old republics or old kingdoms, and all lots of different languages, colors, and creeds. But ultimately, therefore, it had to make a single system under the Napoleonic Code. But the UK doesn't necessarily need that, never needed that. And unfortunately, now the systems are slightly different. But we should still trust each other, to be wanting the best for each other's citizens.
Let me bring in Catherine Barnard on this. Do you agree, Catherine?
There's quite a lot there to take apart, but I think what I would say is that the question of trust, which has just been discussed, is certainly an issue of a problematic issue on both sides. There is, I think, deep mistrust by the EU against the UK because there is a perception that the UK is not standing by the deals that it struck. But equally, on the EU, on the UK side, they say the EU hasn't understood the fact that we have voted to leave the European Union and we want to have an independent trading policy. The problem comes with the Northern Ireland Protocol. And because Northern Ireland has a foot in both camps, both the EU single market and the UK's internal market, the crunch comes on the east-west border. That's the border between, for argument's sake, Liverpool and Belfast, where checks are meant to be taking place. And the fact is that the UK government says, we don't like that. It's unacceptable to have a border down the Irish Sea and separate off part of the territory of the United Kingdom from the control of Westminster. And the fact that part of the United Kingdom is still partially under the control of the EU. And the government is now saying that's totally unacceptable, which is why it wants the Northern Ireland Protocol rewritten, in particular to remove any role for the European Court of Justice. Problem is that the EU says, look, Northern Ireland's got a very special deal. No other country in the world has this possibility of having a foot in both camps. And so long as the Northern Ireland stays in the single market for goods and the EU's customs union, there must be a role for the Court of Justice. And so I think what we'll see in the next couple of weeks, once COP26, that's the big climate conference, which is taking place in Glasgow, has come to an end, is that there will be a renewed focus on the Northern Ireland Protocol. And the interesting question is whether Article 16, which is the safeguard mechanism in the Northern Ireland Protocol, gets triggered.
Yeah, the UK Foreign Secretary on Monday accused France of being at fault. Liz Truss, though, stopping shy of invoking Article 16 of the post-Brexit trade agreement, which would mean the suspension of contentious clauses like the Northern Ireland Protocol.
That's something slightly different. That's the Northern Ireland Protocol. And of course, we're also negotiating about that. But what looking at the dispute resolution mechanism, you know, the French have behaved unfairly. You know, it's not within the terms of the trade deal. And if somebody behaves unfairly in a trade deal, you're entitled to take action against them and seek some compensatory measures. And that is what we will do if the French don't back down.
Hear the Foreign Secretary speaking there. What's your reaction?
Well, I must say that I'm quite surprised, but I remain where I stand. I'm far away from the Foreign Minister. But talking about trust and a partner who can be trusted, I look at Great Britain, UK, which does not respect the treaties. It signed a few weeks ago. Same thing for the fisheries. Same thing for the Northern Ireland protocol. So I don't know who cannot be trusted, but it's pretty clear to me that the UK is not playing a fair game in this. I just want to go back on the situation of the fishermen, because this is really the key point. Okay, you have these discussions between the French and the Brits. Okay, but who is at the middle of this? Who is the first victim of this? Fishermen, both English and French. And we should think to them at first when talking about these issues and showing up your strength in the media and accusing someone of not being fair. Let's think about the fishermen. Fishermen is a very difficult work to do. People die every year. It's a very hard work, probably one of the most difficult and physically difficult work that you can still have. So we should think to them at first. They are going through difficult times. They've been through very difficult times during the COVID crisis because they've sold much less fish as they used to, as the restaurants were closed, for instance. So please, let's focus on their situation. I think that both parties have all the interest to reach an agreement pretty soon. Let's keep in mind that France and President Macron will hold the presidency of the Council of the EU next January. So I don't think that he wants to see his presidency of the EU polluted by the problems with England, talking about Northern Ireland, talking about the fishermen. We need a presidency, a French presidency, which is fully dedicated to talk about real issues such as energy, immigration, defense, and so on and so forth.
All right. I'm not sure Daily Telegraph cartoonist Matt agrees that there's an interest, again, in coming together. He plays a variant on an old proverb, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and you annoy the French for a lifetime, is what's in that cartoon.
No, I saw that. And once again, I mean, you can make all the fun about the situation and draw cartoons and, you know, point the French saying, oh, they've been lying to us. Let's think once again about the core issue which is at stake, the situation, the economic situation of the fishermen, both on the English side and on the French side. Let's think about all these families that don't have a license anymore to fish in the British waters, both in Guernsey and Jersey and in the English coast, as they've been doing for ages and ages. They are the first victims. So we can say whatever we want about Johnson's attitude, about Emmanuel Macron's attitude. It is one thing for the media, mainly. The main thing at stake, once again, is the fisherman situation.
So, Matt Kilcoyne, the first port, the first place that buys the fish from Jersey is Saint-Malo, just across the bay there on the French side. What would you say to fishermen in Jersey?
Well, fishermen in Jersey and fishermen in Saint-Malo are slightly different. But I mean, the seafood in Saint-Malo is fantastic. I'd recommend anybody to go. But I would say that I can't work out if it's the biggest issue in the world or one that's polluted because it's dealing with fishermen's like wages, whether it's polluting, getting to these real issues, as you were just discussing there. We have to remember that the core of this issue is sovereignty. It's actually not for Britain to tell Jersey and Guernsey how to run their internal affairs. They are crown dependencies separate from the United Kingdom. So they have their own legislature. They have their own rights to create quotas now under.
Can
under
they join the EU?
Fishermen. They are not entitled to run their own foreign affairs. So they have to defer on Britain on that one. So that's why we're having the negotiations at the highest level with the United Kingdom and France. Unfortunately, the quotas that they give out, nobody has a right to demand a quota from these territories. These territories are well within their rights to give them as to who they wish to. If they wanted to give one to me, they could, but I'm not going to apply. French fishermen have to apply like everybody else does now, and that just because you've been doing it for ages isn't necessarily a right anymore. And that's absolutely correct, that because this is all about sovereignty. And the British response is being perfectly reasonable to fit within its internal affairs, how it negotiates its affairs with its crown dependencies, just as Britain never gets involved in how France runs its affairs with its overseas departments. And it's actually quite an insult to watch France demand that Britain overrule the devolved administrations, or effectively the crown dependencies' internal affairs. I think we've got to be very careful before we tell other countries imperiously how they run their affairs.
Catherine Barnard, do you agree?
It's slightly more complicated than that because the TCA, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, which is the agreement which governs all of these matters, makes provision for transitional arrangements to whereby boats, French fisher boats, fishermen's boats, which have been fishing around those waters, can apply for a license on the basis of showing a history of having fished in those waters. Now, it's certainly Jersey and Guernsey that have been granting the licences, but if the French think that there has been a breach of the treaty, and indeed it's interesting that the French in their letter to the European Commission indicated that they thought that was the case, it would be the Commission that starts proceedings under Article 506 of the TCA, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, but those proceedings would not be against Jersey and Guernsey, but would be against the UK. And what's interesting is that the French say, and they gave a deadline of Tuesday, they have now pushed back on that, but they said if the UK hadn't sorted out the licences issue by the 2nd of November, they, the French, would then start increasing checks on goods coming into France. And as we know, that would quickly gum up the area around Calais and would cause severe disruption to the UK. And that would be actually a decision of the French. But the actual legal proceedings that Liz Truss was talking about, either brought by the French against the UK or by the UK against France, would be a matter for the Commission and for the UK, not for Jersey and Guernsey.
All right. And Britain, by the way, is an island which brings in more than just fish. In Portsmouth, they're feeling the pinch from what we talked about at the outset, these global supply chain issues, which have been part of the reason we've seen this spike in fuel prices. The UK worried there won't be turkeys in shops for Christmas.
I don't think it's quite as bad as everybody's reading in terms of Christmas. I'm sure we'll all celebrate Christmas and I'm sure we'll all have our Christmas dinners. But in terms of toys and goods, you know, there's going to be some goods that are not going to make it to the shops in time for Christmas.
So pardon the pun, Matt Kilcoyne, but is fishing a red herring? And the real issue is that, well, the bite of the global supply chain, which has nothing to do with Brexit as such, but compounded by disruptions linked to more paperwork, well, they're starting to feel the pinch where you are.
I would say that it very much benefits both Macron and Boris to not be talking about domestic political issues, because their reforms programs on both sides of the channel are not necessarily living up to the best hype. But the vast majority of turkeys are actually sort of grown and slaughtered here in the UK. There's very little chance, if you're after a turkey in the UK, of not finding one for Christmas. The culling for those tends to happen in the next few weeks in sort of East Anglia. But in a very sort of macabre way, actually. But in any way, it doesn't particularly matter. In terms of, yes, I think the supply chain issues is going to hit Christmas. I think a lot more, though, the budget that was happened last week, which is going to have a big squeeze on incomes of people who are just about managing, people in work, those businesses that are reliant on consumer spending, they're going to get really badly hit over the next few months, much more so than anything in any trade spat between the United Kingdom and the European Union. Now, we can always import food from elsewhere in the world. The UK has an incredibly varied internalized supply chain, and it has very, very, very good links with the rest of the world. In fact, the reason why we were so prosperous is because of those global links, in the same way that France was. We need to have a much better understanding of what displacement theory does. If France decides to create checks and gum up Calais, that will hurt themselves. It really is a very silly response to something that is not an internal matter. It's an internal matter for Jersey and Guernsey on the licensing. But it will also hurt Ireland, the people who apparently they're so keen to protect, because you can right now, yes, you can put some stuff through Dublin and through Cork and through Wexford, or even through Northern Ireland, Belfast. But a large amount of traffic goes from east-west across to the UK, down through Folkestone, and then across to the Channel. And if they decide to gum things up, increase checks, increase costs, they're going to increase costs for their member state as well, the consumers at the end. At which point, we've got to ask the question, is the European Union about increasing the life standards of its citizens, the member states, or is it about geopolitics? And if it's about geopolitics, I'm not sure that the citizens ever bought up for that idea.
Pierre Giraud-Ménard.
Well, once again, I'm sorry to repeat myself. This Brexit situation is a lose-lose game. The trade problems experienced all across the planet today, it's not new to the Brexit, but the Brexit certainly puts another pressure on it. And the fact that there have been problems in the gas stations in the UK and in several grocery
stores. We got rising fuel prices here, by the way.
Absolutely. But
buying, but we have had rising fuel prices.
Yes, there have been rising fuel prices in France. But no shortages. All the gas stations.
So let me ask you about this. We have this row over fishing, which we've discussed at length here so far. Yet at the same time, France and the UK cooperate when it comes to stopping migrants from crossing the border. But we're hearing the rhetoric is getting more and more sour. Interviewed on RTL Radio this Thursday mm-hmm. morning, the conservative mayor of the northern port city of Calais laid the blame for migrants in her town with the British and their, quote, generous benefit system for asylum seekers. I'm not sure if that's why people are rushing across to cross the channel, but do you get the sense that this sort of what seems like a bit of brinksmanship can become more and more toxic?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I keep on thinking that whatever happens in the media and the fishermen's situation and the trade relationship between Great Britain and Northern Ireland and the rest of the EU, the UK and France remain very close partners, and everybody has interest for these to remain the same in the future. Yes, you have little things that need to be adjusted because the UK has left once again the family. I I really regretted it for the British people, but that's their sovereign right. And you were mentioning, talking, Minister, about sovereignty. It was a sovereign choice.
Because we live in an age of vitriol. So the more vitriol there is, we saw...
Yeah, I don't think that vitriol is the right... once again, I don't think that vitriol is the right solution.
At some point, does it start to matter, you know, the tweets we saw of the...
No, I'm more... I see the glass half filled and not half empty, and I'm Britain and and France remain very close partners in a lot of areas. Yes, there's been a few difficulties that will be overcome in the next weeks. Everyone has an interest to reach an agreement. Once again, Macron, yes, even though he has the presidential election and he wants to do a lot for the fishermen, as it was said earlier on in the conversation, fishermen is a very important target for the governments, even though it's a very small part of the GDP. It's like the farmers.
But again, it's been the political campaign is beginning. So far, it's been dominated by identity politics. We haven't really gotten into the thick of the campaign yet here in France.
Yeah.
But if it continues the way it has, will flag waving be the norm? And in which case, will it get a lot worse?
Yes. The debate has been dominated by the question of migration, nationality, identity, religion. But let's wait until all the candidates are on the departure line, which we don't know who they are yet. We still don't know. Let's wait until they are. Let's wait until the real campaign has started. And I'm pretty sure that economic matters, cultural matters, justice matters, commercial matters will be on the top of the list.
Catherine Barnard, do you see this row becoming part of a so-called culture war?
Well, there's certainly efforts on both sides to do that. But I think when we're talking about the reason why migrants want to cross the channel, although there's talk about generous benefits, the reality is nothing of the sort. The benefits are extremely miserly. And indeed, life for an asylum seeker in the UK is pretty tough. And they're certainly not allowed to work. But the reason why they want to come to the UK is in part because people smugglers have promised them a land of milk and honey, and in part because they have the language, they find English is more widely spoken amongst those communities. And thirdly, there's probably quite a large diaspora from the countries in which they have come. They've got relatives or friends who they'd like to join. And so the temptation is there to try and get into one of these boats. The current Home Secretary is doing her level best to discourage them from coming. But nevertheless, they are still coming in relatively large numbers. Although it is worth bearing in mind that the UK takes fewer asylum seekers than France and Germany and most other EU states, but it is an issue which is absolutely raw in the UK. As we know, immigration was a big issue in the Brexit debate. That was primarily EU immigration, but there was also a lot of worries about non-EU migration. And that's one of the reasons why Priti Patel is working so hard to try and keep those potential asylum seekers away from the UK coast.
Yeah, the Home Secretary. Writing in the Financial Times, Matt Kilcoyne, Gideon Rackman wrote a couple of days ago a column in which he said that UK-French frictions will also make it harder to form common Western disputes on positions such as China and Russia. He quotes an academic who worries that Britain and France risk turning into the Japan and South Korea of Europe, two close American allies that are also bitter rivals. Do you see that as a possibility?
No, I see France and Germany being that much more than the UK and France. I think the UK's role is to be that central pillar of the second of the three spheres of influence in the West. So America, the United States, and then you've got the Kansas states with the UK at the heart of that and across the Mid-Atlantic and out in the Asia-Pacific. And then you've got the European Union as that third sphere. Now, they overlap, of course, but when they work together, they are much more strong. Now, what I would say is that describing the idea that people are coming to the UK because of our benefit system is grotesque. The fact that we don't allow asylum seekers to work is wrong. We should definitely change that because we accidentally end up creating a lot of our internal issues on criminality and gangs and drug warfare by not allowing people to work in very expensive cities. So they tend to be pushed towards illicit and grey or black market activities. That's the same in France as well and across European Union. But the idea that Britain is a bad place to be, I very much disagree. Britain is a great land of opportunity. As the English speaking world, I would describe it really. I quite like Ms. Bernard's use of the word relatives there, because I call it the general theory or the personal theory of relativity to describe why people move to places, and it typically is because you happen to know somebody somewhere. It's relatively close to you culturally, or it's relatively close to you in linguistic terms. You can get a job. You can imagine yourself in a place. And so people tend to move where their family are and their friends are and where they know and what they think of, what they see in cultural terms. Britain is a great cultural power, soft power right on across the world, on TV screens and movie scenes, in books and in education. The United Kingdom is right there in forefront in people's minds. And so when they sit there and think, what is it that they want from the world when they are up against it, Britain is a great place to come to. And we should be very proud of that. Priti Patel, obviously, her parents are Ugandan Asians. Just before Idi Amin did a crackdown, but they still came to the UK along with a great number of other Ugandan Asians. And also Dominic Raab, the old foreign secretary, his parents his father was a Czechoslovakian Jewish refugee. So they understand, actually, what it means to come to the UK in very desperate and dire circumstances and to want to make the best of it. I think that their approach so far has been pretty bad. I would like them to see a more liberal approach. Actually, the UK public has started to move very much after the Brexit vote, switched its opinion on migration. They're now one of the most pro-migration countries in the world, especially in the Western world. And it should be a time that public policy at home reflected that. And we'd be proud of that Britain, what people want to come to Britain.
Pierre-Jérôme Ménin, there was a revolving door between in the high halls of finance, because Britain being Europe's financial center. But also university students from France going there, from Britain coming here. Do you see it as this? Do you get the feeling that the door has been shut at this point?
No, not at all. I know for particular reason quite well the situation of French students studying in Great Britain. So no doors has been shut, unless for the financial reasons, because now the French students that want to go to a British university need to pay the tuition fees paid by Chinese or Australian or South American people, which was not the case before, because they were able to pretend to the EU tariffs were much cheaper. I just want to go back to what has been said about migration and the fact that the UK is a very welcoming country. Of course it is a welcoming country, shall I say, especially for lorry drivers to bring the gas to the stations that you desperately need. So just a little joke. But of course, UK is a very welcoming country, such as France also. And you're right when you say that people choose the way they want to, the country they want to live in, through the people they know, through the acquaintances that they have in the country, of course.
Do you see right now, Catherine Barnard, the soft power, as described by Mac Kilcoyne, as waxing or waning?
Well, I think we're in a difficult position at the moment. I think the interesting question is what comes out of COP26. There's been some expectation management that there will be very little achieved. In fact, we're seeing that some steps, not great steps, not kangaroo jumps, but at least corgi-sized steps are occurring at COP26. And if COP26 is perceived to be a success, then that will give Boris Johnson and his government a boost to show that they can deliver on the global stage. Of course, on the other hand, we should remember that the situation in Afghanistan, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, was tumultuous, and the implications of that are only just beginning to be felt, not least because there are a large number of Afghan refugees who want to come to the UK and other countries. But all of this will be eclipsed in the UK and probably French debate over the case of what happens if we start some form of trade war with the EU, if we trigger Article 16 of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which may be the case once COP26 comes to an end, and whether we do it gingerly, In which case it's unlikely that the EU will retaliate hard, or whether we do it in a dramatic fashion, in which case it's likely that the EU will retaliate hard, in which case we're in for a very acrimonious period in the run-up to Christmas.
And what are the chances of that happening, of a hard pullout from Article 16, a theatrical departure?
Well, I suspect Boris Johnson hasn't made his mind up yet. He's had quite a lot on his plate with COP26, the debacle in Parliament over the last 24 hours over the behaviour of one particular MP, and the fact that Boris Johnson ordered all of the Tory MPs to vote in a particular way. There's been a huge backlash, and so today has been spent dealing with the fallout from that. And then, of course, there is the issue of the fishing dispute as well. And then COP26 is going on, and then the question is what will happen after that. And the big question is whether Boris Johnson has got the stomach to have a really major fight with the EU, or whether, in fact, when it comes to the brink, he backs down, although it won't be presented as backing down. Remember, too, of course, that COVID cases are still very high in the UK. And so there's quite a lot to be dealt with at the moment.
All right. Will there be acrimony or a Brussels fudge in the end? We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. I want to thank you so much, Pierre-Jérôme Hénin. I want to thank Catherine Barnard and Matt Kilcoyne for being with us from London. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.